about to attempt a crash landing. Please extinguish all cigarettes. Place your tray tables in their upright lock position. Your captain says, put your head on your knees. Captain says, put your head in your hands. Captain says, put your hands on your head, put your hands on your hips. This is your captain. We are going down. We are all going down. Together. And I said, uh-oh. This is gonna be some.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a regular podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We bring you conversations with some of the most amazing people from around the world of the arts. If music, books, theater and dance, visual art, poetry and film are the energy drink that recharges your flagging spirits in these trying times, then you've come to the right place. Be sure to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please leave us your comments, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. And to get more stimulating content, please join us at our website, www.glenngould.ca. And when you're there, you will undoubtedly notice a little donate button. We are a registered Canadian charity, and if you'd like to support us with your generosity, we would be ever so grateful. Now, we have a departure from our usual format because we have two guests today, and it's actually such an accomplished pair that I'm going to dispense with my usual detailed introduction outlining their contributions. In fact, I've resorted to outright plagiarism, going to one of the websites, and this might be the most effective way to do it. So Laurie Anderson, who is joining us, is one of the world's most renowned and daring creative pioneers. Known primarily for her multimedia presentations, she has cast herself in roles as varied as visual artist, composer, poet, photographer, filmmaker, electronics whiz, vocalist and instrumentalist. And that, to put it mildly, barely scratches the surface. Now, joining me along with Laurie is a great friend of the Glenn Gould Foundation, but also of Laurie's, Bob Ezrin. Bob is one of the great music producers of our time, whose vision, leadership, and musical chops have helped give birth to classic recordings from Alice Cooper, Pink Floyd, Kiss, Deep Purple, Taylor Swift, and of course, Lou Reed's legendary Berlin album. Bob's also an entrepreneur and philanthropist, and both Bob and Laurie have belonged to the exclusive club of past chairs of the Glenn Gould Prize jury. Welcome, Laurie and Bob. How are you doing?
We're doing great. Well, I'm doing great, and Laurie looks amazing.
Yeah, I'm feeling good too. Thanks.
That's great. Well, I don't want to start on a down note, but if you look outside your window or turn on your television or other device, you might notice that we're living in pretty dramatic times, and there are a lot of disturbing, disrupting things going on. So I'd like to actually start with the subject of art in times of anxiety and how we use art for comfort and consolation, but also to make sense of what's going on around us. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts and maybe, you know, your personal experience of how you've been engaging with art, music, any form of creative activity during, let's say, this past year that we've been living through.
Laurie, you should start that one.
Okay. Out my window right now is the forest. I'm living on Eastern Long Island and just going into the city, New York City, once every couple of weeks to just get some city energy. it's wonderful there. It's wonderful in New York. It's just tearing my heart out every time I go there. It's quiet. There are no tourists, and I haven't seen that since the 70s. And we all love this so much. You know, when New York became a tourist town, maybe beginning 20 years ago, but really 40, I got into, you know, full-blown Disney mode 20 years ago and has not recovered from that. We began to think of New York as an entertainment American city, which it's really not. And so it's gone back to its port's roots, you know. It's a port, and a lot of people come and go through it. I've just really been enjoying Fran Lebowitz's new Netflix thing, in which she says she's on a crowded sidewalk. Her Netflix series is called Pretend It's a City. And she's on a crowded sidewalk, and all of these tourists are going, wow, look at that, look at that. And it's just traffic, big traffic jam of pedestrians. And she's saying, move. Pretend it's a city, you know. Pretend you have somewhere to go. Pretend you have a job. Pretend you're not just gawking at the sights, you know. So I appreciate her, and a lot of other New Yorkers who are beginning to think like, wow, we have our city back. Mm-hmm. We also have our pods back. You know, we have our friendships that are people who help us get through this really crazy, crazy era. Truly crazy and scary too, and they are around. So I began by trying to think at the beginning of the pandemic, what's going to work? How can we communicate? So I started a radio series called Party in the Bardo, and that was WESU from Middletown, Connecticut, and it was I'd always dreamed to have my own late night radio show. And yeah, I was going to live in San Francisco, and I was going to, the show was going to start like 5 a.m. at this point where, you know, it was too early to start, well, actually 4 a.m. really, because people in SF are already commuting, you know, at 5. They're on the road, on the way to work, till 4. When you're just like not sure what's real, what's not real, you're coming out of your dreams, you're like, oh, where am I? Who am I? You don't exactly know who you are anymore, which is really great. And I thought, that's the time I want to talk to people. So Party in the Bardo was a series of 11 two-hour shows, and they were very rambly things, but they were radio. And I thought, that's what you do in wartime. Mm-hmm. Radio works. So listening, and here we are on Zoom, which is another thing that kind of works. What do you think, Bob? How did you start the pandemic?
Let me go back a little earlier than that, because my parents bought me a tape machine when I was 11 years old. In fact, my uncle was the first person to have stereo in Canada.
And what?
we smuggled it in from Buffalo on a family trip. And
oh, man, that's great.
And he was the largest collector of jazz recordings, private collector of jazz recordings in the country. So in his basement, he had 20,000 albums, jazz albums, and all sorts of other kinds of stuff. And he had turntables, and he had tape recorders.
Whoa.
And I became addicted to the smell of tape. But also, he had a Zenith shortwave radio, a Zenith Worldmaster, which was this massive black thing with a huge antenna that you would raise up, and then you would DX, meaning listening to stations from far, far away. And I became addicted to radio.
Oh, gosh.
So then my parents bought me a tape machine. I think it was 11, maybe 12, of my own. Very cheap little, it was Simpsons, I think it came from, you know, so it was a Kenmore, right, or something like that. And I used to sit in my window looking out over Lyndhurst Avenue in Toronto, downtown Toronto, and the traffic would go by, and I'd pick it up on the microphone, and I had my little my record player beside me, and I was Bob King with the King thing.
Oh,
coming
yes.
to you from Toronto. And I always I always dreamed of having my own radio show. And so it's listening to what you're talking about, you know. And by the way, I loved the series. And
thanks.
And I was a little disappointed you never called me.
No. Yeah.
But anyway.
You're next on my list.
Oh, yeah, sure. But so the radio, you know, you're right. And what was it that made it so magical? What was it about radio that is part of what we're experiencing now? It was, you were alone in your own little space, which became almost invisible, and that through some kind of celestial beam, you reached out and could travel the whole world and could imagine. Like, I used to get Trucker's Watch out of New Orleans. When they would do, wow. You know, there were certain times when the AM signal would skip, and you could pick it up all the way up here. Or WWVA, Wheeling, West Virginia. and actually, when I was listening to Wheeling, West Virginia, there was a commercial for a movie that was out, and it said, you know, I can't remember the title, and it was like, you know, 75 cents and 25 cents for colored seats. And I said to my dad, what color are the seats?
Yeah.
Why are, you know, what color are the seats that they're cheaper? You know, that, so.
What did your dad say?
He explained it to me.
He
very
did.
Well.
Okay.
Yes, he did. But anyway, I feel like we are in a similar place. That all that is around us immediately has become invisible. It's just because we're here so much that we don't see it anymore. And what's happened is that we've reached out through technology, through Zoom, through, you know, even our mobile phones, these magical devices that can allow us to connect with people all over the universe. And we can project ourselves into these places. So it's freed us up for imagination incredibly. I mean, suddenly, you know, your context disappears. When context disappears, everything is possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened, is our context has become so... It's just so basic that it has disappeared altogether. We don't notice it anymore. I don't notice this desk anymore. I don't notice, you know, my bedroom. I've just spent more time in it in this last year than I've ever done in my life. So, yeah, that's what I'm doing. And the other thing I want to say is that I think that when you are separated like this from other people for such a long period of time, you begin to experience things more deeply and more profoundly than you may have before, mainly because you don't even have any distractions. It's just like you're there with your thoughts and your dreams and your fears and your pain and whatever else happens to be happening to you at the time. And that has a lot to do with the acceleration of good and bad behavior that we see around us. That people have been separated from their distractions so long that their true natures or their fears or whatever is driving them has been amplified, and they're doing more of everything. So we have more anarchy, we have more love, we have more ugliness and more beauty, we have more communication, and we have more distance, all happening at the same time. So I think this is, I've never lived through anything like it, but I'll never forget it. I've been writing about it to myself and you know, as part of this interminable memoir.
Oh, how's that going? You
know, oh, it's terrible.
What page are you on?
Well, I don't know about numbers of pages. I do it by words, but I'm about 70,000 words in now.
And are you doing it chronologically?
No. No, in fact...
That's a relief.
Yes, it is. It's really interesting. So,
not that I wouldn't like to know about Little Bob when you're three.
Little Bob?
Little Bob when he's three.
Yeah.
I would love to know about that guy.
Really?
Yeah, I would.
I want to know about the Shreddies commercial.
Oh, okay.
He was a jingle singer.
You're kidding.
Okay, so here's the story. One of my mother's closest friends was a woman named Charlotte Deneve, who was a dancer from Bali.
Lovely.
And only in Canada, on Saturday night, prime time, would the 7:30 show be Garbutt Roberts and Charlotte Deneve dancing Balinese dances. But that was
wonderful.
It was live TV, right? This was not recorded, and it was a lead-in show to a program starring a kind of Irish tenor named Billy O'Connor. He was our Bing Crosby. So Charlotte had said to my mom, you know, you and the kids, you ought to come down, you know, while we're doing the show. So my dad took my little brothers, who were twins, redheaded twins. They went and stood in line to go to the Garbutt Roberts Charlotte Deneuve show. And the producers of Billy O'Connor show came down the hallway and they looked at them and they went, Mike, they're like miniature Billies.
Miniature Billies? Whoa.
So the producer comes down the hall and he said, they're like miniature Billies. And they don't sing, do they? And of course, you know, we're an all singing, all dancing family, right? So my dad goes, 5, 6, 7, 8, my brother's breaking, I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad. And, you know, and the guys, they're like flipping out. They're going, okay, they're hired. We want them for the Christmas special. So they got hired on the spot. They were five and a half, I think. And he says to my dad, you don't have any more of those at home, do you? And that was it. So we became the kind of go-to kids for, you know, when you needed somebody on, like a kid on live TV, to stand around and be in a sketch. Or I played Jack Duffy's son, Johnny Wayne's son in the Wayne and Schuster show. Do you remember Wayne and Schuster, Lori?
No, sorry.
Okay.
I don't remember Wayne.
Wayne and Schuster.
What was the idea of their show? What was their?
They were a comedy team.
And slapstick or
no,
kind of comedy?
No, they were smart comedy, mm-hmm. very very verbal. And Frank Schuster's daughter was Lorne Michaels' first wife, and Lorne Michaels learned a lot from that era of Canadian television. So, but anyway, that's I digress. So we were kind of go-to kids, and then somebody said, well, you know, we need some kids to do this commercial for Shreddies, which is mini shredded wheat in the United States, but Shreddies in Canada. And so we got hired, the three of us, and we became the Shreddies kids.
Oh my gosh.
Not on camera. The kids that were on camera when we first did it were animated, and then they did hire a Shreddies kid, and that was Alan Cates, K-A-T-E-S, right. Who ended up being my partner in Nashville. And I mean, like, crazy. Like, neither of us had any idea. But, yeah, Toronto was a very exciting place at that time. It truly was like this little village full of crazy creative people doing everything. Right. And they all knew each other.
And Justin, to counteract the idea that we were a totally isolated enclave, Wayne and Schuster actually had a long-standing gig with the Ed Sullivan Show. They were on over and over again on Ed Sullivan. So if you pick up the Ed Sullivan archives, you'll run into them.
I think I'm going to have to do that.
Yeah. They were his favorite comedians, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so
glad this came up.
We're firmly in memory lane, but actually I really am struck by your gravitation towards radio, which is, you know, despite the fact that we're doing a quote-unquote podcast, it's radio.
Yeah,
you know,
radio.
That's really what it is. It's just a different wire connecting the people and the sound. And that actually raises a very interesting paradox, because radio, I agree, it's primal and powerful. No matter how wonderful the ability of Hollywood is to create CGI FX, we can do better inside our own heads pretty much any day of the week. And, you know, Orson Welles said that his favorite medium was radio drama, not film or television or stage. And, of course, you know, radio was a big part of Glenn Gould's creative life. So the ability to be isolated and yet connected is one of those interesting paradox. But it also says, and this is interesting for you two, because you're both people who have had a lot of technology in your lives, and you're very closely associated with it. Are we on the verge of discovering low-tech solutions to the inner moment that we're all sort of going through right now? And do you see a bit of a turning back in terms of how we navigate the world and these strange times?
Well, I guess I don't see forward motion in the same way. One of the things that the pandemic has done for me is put me, like everyone else, in the present. If you're going to be, like, walking along towards the future, and thinking, you know, you're getting somewhere. We're all in this much stranger position. We're walking along, but the future keeps getting farther and farther away, smaller and farther away. Things keep getting postponed. The thing that was going to happen in June is happening next June. You know, so this time shift is really a completely new experience. And I train to be in the present. My practice is trying to do that. So, and then I thought, how amazing that the entire world just became kind of like instant Buddhists. They're like, yep. You don't know what's going to happen. You have no idea.
That's right.
So just look around you, breathe deep, and see what happens.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Who would ever have imagined this? So,
well, I think people did. I think it, you know, as you say, this is your practice. I mean, I think that it was not only imagined, but clearly understood by other cultures before us. I think Western cultures sort of shed that knowledge as it, you know, I'm making quotation marks in the air, but as it evolved, or rather, you could say devolved into a state of reliance upon other, you know, like, you rely on technology, you rely on other people, you rely on techniques. You are rarely just being. Whereas, you know, if we got ourselves into, if we were able to go to the Amazon, to one of those tribes, and sit there quietly and not disturb them or give them germs, we could at least observe that they just were who they were all the time. Like, 24 hours a day. Now, yes, they have structure. They have developed mechanisms, coping mechanisms for their animal instincts versus their humanity and all that other stuff that we've done too. But they don't have all these additional layers of separation between them and whoever they're dealing with, or whoever they have to hunt, kill, and eat. You know, it's very immediate, very direct. So, I don't think there's a backwards or forwards. I'm with Lori on this. You know, I don't think we're going anywhere. And I think that this is the new
parked.
Yeah, we're parked. And guess what? We always were. It was an illusion. We thought we had progress, all these plans we made. You know the joke that's, you know, how to make God laugh is to make plans, you know, and
right.
But in a way it's true. Like, we all have these plans and these ideas and schedules, and I've got a date, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. And then one thing came along and changed all of it.
Yeah.
And so what that says is, where's the value in your life?
Yeah.
And and for me, the value, I'm an accidental Buddhist. You know, Lori's a practicing Buddhist. I'm a Buddhist by sort of, you know, I tripped into it in a way, because I've always, my life has always been about the people that I love and the ideas that are happening right now.
All musicians are Buddhists.
I think you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's not just musicians.
Is there anything more in the present to do than music? No. Absolutely not. And you can't, like, skim it to the end of it or something.
No,
you know,
true.
You can't speed read it. You have to sit there in real time and listen to it. That's called real time. So musicians are already way out there. But this idea that progress has to do with technology is the one that always surprises me, because of course it doesn't. It claims to, you know, it claims to be the thing that's pushing us into the future. One of my favorite quotes, I think it was a cryptologist, and I can't remember his name right now, but he said, you know, if you think technology is going to solve your problems, you don't understand technology, and you don't understand
your problems.
I love that.
Yeah, wasn't a cryptologist. It was somebody that we all know, but I can't remember who it is.
A lot of people have quoted this, and I think I've traced it back to this guy.
Oh, yeah?
A lot of people are running it through the mill, and I think he was the, oh, well, who knows who when a thought first came through whose mind, you know, who cares really.
Right.
But we are caught into this kind of treadmill that has stopped.
We are
the merry-go-round. It stopped.
It stopped. Yeah, exactly. And we're stuck in place, and then we have to attend to the place. You know, suddenly we can't ignore the place. The place we've been in all along, which is right here, right here. We're stuck in it, and now we're having to tend to it. And some people are doing it rather badly.
You know? When you went like this, I was just thinking. I got up this morning, and I order like probably 5 books a week now, and I read many of them, or at least I skim them.
I know, me too. I'm terrible.
This is my, you know, this is like, and so.
By the way, before you finish that, have you read Matthew McConaughey's book?
No.
It's a trip.
Okay,
it's
what is it?
So good. It's called Green Lights.
Right.
And it's just so impressive because it's exactly what we're talking about, but in folk language, you know, he just
I have to order it right now.
Green Lights, Matthew McConaughey.
Green Lights, okay.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, on the top of the stack of books, the smallest one, the shortest one, which I thought I can read that before I have some coffee, is a play by Sam Shepard called A Lie in the Mind. Mm-hmm. And in this wonderful play starring Harvey Keitel way back in 1985, it's a typical story of many of Shepard's plays, two brothers, crazy father, guns and flags. And I thought, oh boy, this is Boogaloo. Mm-hmm. This is
Proud
Boogaloo
Boys.
And
Proud Boys.
It's always been here from the beginning of this place. What are we so shocked about? You know, so on the other hand, when you hope for insight into what to do in that situation, I'm not sure that I closed the play and went, oh, I could have this feeling towards them or that one. I just had the intellectual, conceptual realization, yes, these crazies have been here hiding behind that woodwork the whole time. And now suddenly, so we're recording this on the day of that we had the headlines, impeachment this big, you know, mm-hmm. and the only president who's been impeached twice. We have no idea where this is going, except that also on the front page was the Capitol building with hundreds of National Guards soldiers. In what appeared to be sleeping poses, I hope they're not dead, but they're napping for sure, getting ready for something. So everybody in this country today is wondering what that thing is, our entire Capitol building draped with soldiers, something nobody could ever have imagined. Forget the pandemic, forget the slowdown. Right. This for us is a point in time where we actually have zero idea where it's going to go, and the stakes are quite high today.
They are high. But actually, I think it has been imagined, actually, in the past. If you're familiar with Sinclair Lewis, his last book, mm-hmm. his last novel was called It Can't Happen Here, and it was written in 1936. And it actually tells the story of a populist fascist becoming the president of the United States and ushering in a fascist state. Incidentally, all the people who aren't down with fascism end up emigrating to Canada. So
not again.
Not again. You're always welcome. You're always
Thank
welcome.
Thank you so much. You know, we'll see how long always lasts.
Yeah. But I have to say, we gave the Glenn Gould Prize to Philip Glass back in 2016, and it was 2 weeks after Trump's election, so I asked him if he was planning on spending a lot more time at his summer home in Cape Breton, and mm-hmm. he said, oh, no, less. Now is the time to stay and fight. So, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot to be said for staying engaged, but
yes.
you're right. The force of this kind of, I don't want to use an ism word to describe it, but let's say this kind of destructive force is always with us. And sometimes it takes an individual who becomes the match on the pile of oil-soaked rags. But I think that to a certain degree, you know, we all have to be inwardly and outwardly vigilant. And I know that you were, because I was following Ruckus. So, Laura, that was an initiative that you helped start, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that came from a musician's breakfast club. That was Ryuichi Sakamoto and Arta Lindsay and Ian Newton and I sitting around talking. We just decided, let's get together and talk about music. So we did that every week or so in New York. And then when we all went online, we kept doing it. And then as the pandemic unfolded, we thought, why is it so quiet here? And why aren't American artists, writers, musicians saying anything? What happened to the left? What happened to this powerful voice of the left? What happened to Susan Sontag and the rest? You know, it's like, and it was just this, and it is continuing. So, you know, we were saying, why don't we just at least have a couple of days where we ask a lot of artists, musicians, and writers to write something about this, and then we will make a site, and then we're going to make a big noise. And so,
well, here's something that was written to me by an artist. I'm not going to tell you who.
Okay, great.
I do not see the intermingling and bleeding danger from radical far right into the majority of the conservative movement as you do. I am, however, concerned and fearful about the increasingly emboldened liberal McCarthyism running amok in today's society, with big tech, Hollywood, and the media mainstream censoring, squashing, canceling, ostensibly purging out any point of view, political, philosophical, or otherwise, that they do not agree with.
Mm-hmm. Well, media is getting a very rough time these days.
Yeah. But what we have to be aware of is that on the left, you know, where I proudly stand, Proudly.
Oh, proudly, okay.
Yes.
Just probably? What is he talking about?
Easy girl.
He's a leftist proud boy.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, but on the left, yeah. I do think that we are sometimes guilty of demonizing and...
of course.
And
absolutely.
And this sort of can't... Whatever. I hate that term, cancel culture.
So do I.
But I don't think anyone, left, right, or center, is paying enough attention to the burgeoning white power movement in our society and to the threat that that represents, not just to, you know, lefties and people like that, but it's literally, it's pro-white, Anglo-Saxon, primarily Christian, and nobody else. And everybody else has to go home, they say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where's that?
Yeah.
And the, you know, the language that they're using in their online and their postings and their secret little, you know, QAnons and things like that, the language has to do with reclaiming America for the, you know, for the white European people
of course,
to which it belongs, right?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, denying of course, you know, of course who we stole it from and everybody else that lives here. I worry about it greatly. And
me
I
too.
Worry about it because I remember as a child, I'm old enough to remember as a child, Helen and Sydney, my cousins, who had tattoos on their arm with numbers on them, and the stories of how they were both married to someone else, and they both had families, and they lost them all. They met each other in a camp, and they decided to get married. And they...
What a profoundly optimistic and fantastic thing that is.
Isn't it?
We meet in a camp and let's get married. We've lost everyone.
Isn't it?
I mean, who does that? That's my hat's off to these two people did that.
But we have to know that these things have happened in the past, that people who are committed to a cause that is so monochromatic, simple-minded, based on such a sense of entitlement and separation from everybody else around, that those things turn very ugly and very dangerous, and they end up costing a lot of people their lives. And so you're right. I mean, it's terrible to see the National Guard on the Capitol building, but it's way, way worse from my point of view to see these crowds marching, bearing, you know, insignias and emblems and things like that of a very powerful
And this is not a popular thing to say, what I'm going to say, but, and I do totally acknowledge that 57% of white women voted for Trump.
Yeah.
Women pushed him right over,
Yeah.
But the rage that was at the Capitol insurrection was men.
Yes, it was.
There were very few women with guns, very few women doing that, very few women going, get down on the fuck, you know, on the ground. You know, there were very few, one or two, and they got shot. It's the rage that is going on, and it's the rage of men who
but
say, I am not going to share what I have with women, and I'm not going to share it with black people, ever. You kill me before that happens. And that is who's doing this.
And Jews. You know, I just
don't forget Jews.
Yeah.
Don't forget Jews.
So,
well,
so
and Muslims. And Muslims.
And Muslims.
Yeah, yes. Well, yeah. That sort of goes without saying. But unfortunately, the Muslims are in a basket that is, you know, being denied by people on both sides. It's not just the white supremacists. It's a crazy misunderstanding. But so you say, you know, artists. So where's the voice? And yeah. I think that this may be the greatest disappointment of this time for me. Mm-hmm. This last couple of months and stuff, as this was beginning to really ratchet up. I didn't hear us. I keep getting these the Billboard bulletin. You know, just because I'm on the mailing list, I don't read Billboard anymore. I haven't for years.
Haven't you? When was the last Billboard you read? What year?
It would be, it's got to be before the year 2000, so I don't remember.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. But the headlines are always about, you know, this one's got a number one record, and this one, and that one, and but I don't see the voices of leadership and dissent. I don't see the voices of inspiration, I'm missing out something that we saw. We lived through this, all of us, when the civil rights movement was growing and becoming and becoming more and more a cultural imperative, and it was kids that were driving it, and it was our voices, the voices of these kids who were really, really passionate and smart and touched by whatever that angel is that allows people to have brilliant language on beautiful melody and put it all together. And the protest songs, some were so stirring and moving and amazing, and they fueled the movement.
Yeah.
I can't think of a song right now.
Okay, but here's another thing. Kids can't do everything, and kids now are passionate, smart, and activist, and what they're doing is climate. And frankly, you know, I'm glad for that commitment. I mean, I know that this is important, what's going on, but the much bigger picture.
Oh, you're right. No. Like, listen.
And they are really out there doing stuff.
Even in the climate movement, the kids are there. I know they're there. You know I know they're there. I'm supporting so many of these different groups and stuff.
Yeah.
But where's the music? Where's the song?
Okay.
That's what I'm missing. Where's
the
anthem?
Where's the music that does that? Okay.
Where's the anthem that we can rally around? Where's the We Shall Overcome? Where's the, you know...
why is that, Bob?
The times they are a-changing.
Why is that?
Well, because
the times they did change.
Times they did change. I think part of it is that we're in a Neil Postman era and we're amusing ourselves to death. You know, part of it is we have too many distractions and there are too many things we're being asked to attend to and we're not getting particularly.
I think you're right on.
And I think we're not getting particularly good in any one of them, and that's, you know, that's the thing. Like
that's the most obvious explanation and absolutely the truest. Absolutely. I mean, it's just too much stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, I feel that in my own life. It's just too much stuff. I can't do it.
But let me ask a couple more questions about that. I mean, I think you're probably both familiar with the film Bob Roberts, the Tim Robbins film, about the messages and style and tropes of the protest music era being co-opted by the extreme right. I'm going to jump back another 400 years to Martin Luther, who, you know, people said, well, if you're such a sacred man, why are you writing all this music? And he said, why should the devil have all the best songs? So I'm wondering whether part of the answer also is everyone is so afraid of offending a potential market. You know, 71 million people voted for Donald Trump, and everyone's scared of, you know, basically being boycotted by that segment of the market. There's a lot of money in, among those people. So,
but Brian, I think that there are many people who are not afraid of that, who don't really think about that, and they still don't come up with the stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so,
but there's not a big culture for it, and people waiting for that song. They're not, you know, they're just they're working on their own profile. This is my worst nightmare, is the role I had in passing that along. This genuinely makes me incredibly upset to think that. I mean, I got roped into this branding thing because it was, you know, record companies, and you had to, like, say, what's your style? Who are you? You know, push it, stay with it, stick with it, do it, redo it. Why? Because you're selling it. You are a product. So do this, make that. And I thought that was a joke. You know, it was something I did as a joke. I never took that seriously for one second. I never thought that was me going like, hey, ho, wow. I never thought that. I could walk away from that, by the way, nor did anybody else. It was a game.
No, they didn't think that was you.
But it's not a game anymore.
Well, it's never, you know, this is
for kids who are creating their personalities that way.
Well, yeah. Yes, I think this is a really long conversation is what I think. But I think I think personal branding has become an obsession. Mm-hmm. I think fame has become an obsession. Yeah. I think acceptance has become more of an obsession than it was maybe when we were little, but maybe not. Maybe because we wanted to be accepted too.
We wanted the
group to love us. And, you know, I played guitar.
Just a smaller group.
Well, yeah. I play guitar and sang songs because I wanted girls to like me.
Of course.
Right? I mean, that was the thing.
No question about it.
And I couldn't drag
just like
my,
a bird.
Yeah, couldn't drag my piano to parties. You know?
It's a courtship ritual. Right.
This is not a nightmare that you rightfully should take on. You didn't contribute to any of this stuff. If anything, you were...
Yeah, I was. I might have been. I did it, and it was misinterpreted, perhaps, by other people. But, well, I mean, they had plenty of other role models for that. So
yeah, what I loved about what you were doing then, and what I just love that you continue to do, is you've always kind of turned a truthful but funhouse mirror on the rest of us, and through your own experience, you show us, you know, the little fragile points, the funny points, the not so funny points, and I always thought that you were thumbing your nose.
Oh, no, I don't think I was trying to do that.
Not at us, at the system. I always thought that was true, it was thumbable. You were always thumbing your nose at the system, and I don't think anybody looks at you as somebody that contributed to that. If anything, you were, you know, you...
Okay, I'm going to take that off my mea culpa thing right away.
Yeah. Please do. And, you gave us hope. I want to tell you a story.
Great.
I was on my way to the studio. I think what year did Superman come out? Was it 80?
Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm on the way to the studio. I'm driving on the 401 in Toronto for all of us Canadians. And I'm supposed to get off to head to the studio. And Superman comes on Chum FM. And all of a sudden, like, literally, my brain expanded in the brain pan and started like beating against the sides of my skull, because it was just like, it was the strangest and most wonderful and at the same time most seductive thing I'd ever heard. I couldn't believe what I was listening to, and it was long. So I went the whole song. And however long it was, that's how far I went past my exit. And I got, you know, like I was in another place. I didn't even know where I was. I had to pull off, and I had to listen, and then I called the radio station. As you could do in those days. I called the radio station.
Yeah, you could.
They didn't even say hello. They just said, Laurie Anderson. Because apparently I wasn't the only one calling. And
isn't that funny? That's weird.
Well, that's the first... Oh. That's when I phoned you, if you remember, way back then, because mm-hmm. I had this insane idea that we could do a kind of Dada-esque thing with you and Alice Cooper, which I thought would have been just the weirdest combination in history. You were not interested at the time, and I completely understand why.
Is it too
late?
No. Can we do it now?
Yes, we can. We should.
I'm available.
Okay. I think he is, too.
Okay. It's time to do that project.
Yeah. And then...
50 years
later. A few years later, I walked into a hotel in the south of France and stuck around the corner, hiding in a little corner there, was my dear friend Lou Reed with Laurie Anderson. And I thought, this is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Because I just loved...
Hi, Lou.
Because I loved him so much, and I wanted him to have... A beautiful life, and I was so in love with Laurie from a distance, right? That I just thought, okay, this is awesome, you know. Way to go, guys! And so there's my little story, Brian.
Well, let me actually talk a little bit about Oh Superman, and you know, when you have a hit, it can be a little bit of a distorting lens because you know, I mean, Your work is massive and in so many different areas, but that was the thing that basically brought you to a wide public. And you'd been solidly part of the avant-garde, you stayed part of the avant-garde, but suddenly everybody gets you, and the whole part of the mystique of the avant-garde is nobody gets you, right? So what was it like to be sort of plunged into this, you know, I'm a celebrity and I've got a pop hit? You know, that must have been very strange.
It was strange, but it also, more than an artist and more than a pop artist, I was a journalist. And I was, like, really fascinated by this, genuinely, because it was so bizarre. You know, I was the same person that I was 2 weeks ago. Now I would get out of a car, and hundreds of people were around me screaming. So I was like, okay, this is, first of all, A, this is not real. So it's probably the thing, one of the things that I'm quite genuinely proud of, that that didn't seduce me. Mm-hmm. I didn't start thinking of myself any differently. I was still the person that didn't know what to do, where to go, how to do it. Let me try something else. You know, I was still that person. And I never became the person that was in the poster. Right. I got some really wonderful advantages from being in that position. I was able to do other things, you know, work in a different way. But I could see right away. I remember the first time I was out at, I was invited to Burbank, the record company, and Warner Brothers, and they were like, they said, well, we'd like you to meet some of the other artists. And artists had, like, big, heavy quotes around it. And I was like, wow, you're not talking about Picasso here. You know, and some of the artists. And then I forget what the group was. They didn't have a long life, but they were... Guys are like, I'm not... Oh, fuck. You know, and you artists should meet each other. I was like,
really?
Who are you? I knew right away. It was a different world. And I should be an anthropologist in this because it was a wonderful chance to see how this was going down. So
right. It's so funny, I ban the word, the A word, from any of the stuff that I'm working on. I mean, there are a few people who deserve that mantle. You're one for sure. Because, you know, true artists are... It's almost as though they have accidentally slipped into a kind of a celestial jet stream that carries them along, and suddenly they're being bathed in all of this new kind of thinking, new ideas, compulsions, obsessions, and things that they can't even explain to themselves. And lucky for us, in many cases, they will... like drop a rope ladder, like a golden mm-hmm. rope ladder down, and some of us will be inspired by what they do and we'll climb up to and get into that jet stream. But in the rest of their lives, all around that stuff, they're just like people. And there are people that have, you know, people type issues and things that they have to deal with and concern themselves with. The artists, the ones in the jet stream, they spend less time worrying about that part of things and more time just trying to stay afloat in this, like, in this riptide, you know, that they're being carried along by. And so they have ideas and thoughts and things that are informed by the earth and by their experience back here at home, but are completely rewritten and restructured and come out in an entirely different individual and yet collective way that they then turn around and share with the rest of us. And that somebody that's doing that, that's an artist. Somebody who's playing guitar, even if they're really, really good, and they're playing because, you know, they're getting paid a crap load of money and they like the girls and all that other stuff, that's a different kind of a motivation and a different kind of
result. Yeah, but
I've
known some guitarists who are riding a jet stream. You know?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Bill Frisell comes to mind.
But he's listen, David Gilmore writing it.
A whole ton of them. A whole ton of guitarists are out there.
I've been so lucky to have been able to work with some of those people, and they really deserve the mantle. But I'm saying in a general sense. And what I do believe is that even in times when the people are pious, God may grant us four or five artists in an age. You know, we don't get a lot of those. It's not like there's one in every house like a color TV. It's a word that we overuse. We abuse it and overuse it. And it's also a position that we impose on people who can't really deal with it.
Well, it's also so many things have gotten corralled into the under the term art.
Under the A word.
Since Duchamp started doing that, you know. And so, you know, and art no longer is stuff in, for example, in the visual art world, stuff in museums.
Right.
It is really about... those are the tchotchkes that get preserved from other times that are labeled that. But the actual experience of art is not in a museum.
Right.
So you don't even... Those are prompts, maybe. But the actual experience is something else. So it's easy then for us all to be artists. I think it would be a dream for everyone in the world to be... an artist, and maybe that's where we're going, because we are very slowly, very incrementally getting more complex, and I think it's complexity that helps you get up to the jet stream, you know, and also shedding of your need to have a self, you know. For me, that's probably the biggest thing that I've never been an artist because I wanted to express myself ever.
Right.
I don't care if you know me or not.
No.
I mean, I just like see this thing over there and go, that is like crazy. So you head towards that and hope for the best, you know.
Right.
And if everyone in the world could have that feeling, then that would be paradise.
It would be, but it's not reality. You know, my daughter Sarah was working in the movie business. She'd graduated from college, and she was working for some... It was like swimming with sharks. She was working for for, you know, a producer who would yell if the coffee was 108 degrees versus 109, you know, stuff like that. And then her mom was diagnosed with lung cancer, and we knew that it was terminal. And she called me one day. She was 26. She called me and she said, I'm thinking about quitting the movie business. And she said, you know, I don't want to wake up one day at 35 with an ulcer and a Porsche, which I thought was really great. I said, well, those are the wisest words. Yeah, they go together. I said, those are the wisest words I've heard in a long time. But she said, am I making a terrible mistake? And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Would you die if you didn't make a movie? And she thought about it for at least a minute, and I already knew the answer. And she came back and said, I really, really want to make one, but I could give it up because it's just not a great life for all this. And I said, then you have to quit, because there are two kinds of people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who work to achieve an end, whether it's feed their family, get rich, get powerful, own the Porsche, whatever it is. They're working to get something and to do something. And then there's the people who are born with a calling and they have no choice. They are born with something that they have to do. It's a kind of artistic imperative, and if they don't do it, it drives them crazy, or they become alcoholics, or their lives are terrible. And sometimes their lives are terrible because they do it. That sometimes they pay a huge price for living up to what it is that they were put here to do.
Yeah.
And I said, you're not in that second group. And if it was me, you look at the other thing, it's not worth going through that kind of hell just to get money or get the car or even make a movie. If you don't have to do it, you have to quit.
Right.
And she did.
Yes,
and she's a yoga teacher trainer and a yoga instructor, and she's brilliant.
What a wonderful dad thing you just did for a person, She asked you. She wanted to know.
Yeah, she wanted to know because she was afraid that she was going to be making a terrible mistake, that she had this great opportunity, that people were telling her was such a great opportunity. Oh, you're going to be a big star. You can make movies. You can do all that stuff. And it wasn't resonating. This resonates with her, what she's doing now. Yeah.
I mean, that's the only thing that matters, because you can be a great movie producer and it'll resonate and it'll be fantastic. But if it wasn't doing that for her, I mean, there's nothing, well, I should just stop saying stupid stuff like that. There's nothing that is,
Now you have to finish this.
I do judge what's bad and good sometimes. Although, I am trying to see negative situations as great opportunities. That's one of the things that I really believe in, that it's a great moment to make something that can move ahead,
Yeah. No, we have to. We have to look at every situation in our lives, every challenge, every project that we do, every song we write. We have to look at it as an opportunity to do something special and beautiful. And sometimes we get there, and more often than not, we don't. And that's okay, too, because we get another shot, it's like ideas are kind of like, they're like streetcars. If you miss this one, there's another one coming. It's like the train that Brian takes.
I love that attitude
that Brian takes on the way to work. It's like you miss this one, there's another one coming. And
that's wonderful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Take the stress out.
Yep. And by the way, Laurie, in reference to the point about suddenly being immersed in celebrity, I never for a second thought that you were bought into that. In fact, one of the things that I see in almost all your work is what I call a kind of bemused compassion, and that's so beautifully on display. I was looking at your first appearance on Letterman from 1984, and he so clearly didn't get it, and I don't think that his audience
got it.
That might
have been my only one.
but you were so nice to him, but at the same time, you were projecting this idea of sort of knowing that he didn't get it, not holding it against him, but also kind of in a sly way laughing at the silliness of it?
Well, yeah, being a geek, I relate to geeks. I love geeks. But he was just not in a geek mood that day, I guess.
Yeah.
Ooh. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I think he's a pretty interesting guy.
He is. But, and I think his show evolved a lot over the years.
Yeah.
So, but that was much more in a, I think he was in a very mainstream entertainment mode at that point. And he just didn't know what to make of you. And, that's actually a good place for artists to be in sometimes, because if people are scratching their head, then at least they're thinking about what they're seeing and experiencing. And, you've never been afraid of moving in directions that wouldn't necessarily, quote unquote, make sense to people, but at an inner level, an emotional associative level, it does make sense. It makes a lot of sense.
I've got one that doesn't obviously make sense, but we're going to do this because we've been talking about it for too long. We're going to do a Christmas album, yes. Laurie Anderson Christmas album.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Because I just want her point of view on the holiday and the experience and all that sort of stuff. We have to do this, Laurie.
You know, I know we do. And, you know, one project that I've been working on, and maybe it will help with this, is right before the pandemic, I was in Australia working with a machine learning group and a supercomputer, and I was the artist in residence there for a couple of weeks. So they were like, what do you want this supercomputer to do? I was like, I don't know. Can't it think of its own things to do? And it's like, anyway, I said, okay, what we're going to have this do is learn to read the Bible, because everyone's always banging on that book, citing it, telling you what it is and what it should be and what it isn't, and when you know, and telling you have to believe in it. So I'm like, all right, so we've done a lot of experiments over the last year, and some of them are top secret. Some of them aren't. So anyway, the first thing we did was take the elements that make up the Bible, the three streams of languages that come in to create the book, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. We thought, what if we up the level of, for example, Greek? What if the Bible is really predominantly that stream? Is it going to be a much more rational book? What about if the Hebrew comes in, will it be a much more mystical book? What will happen if you see, take the parts apart? Then the next thing we did was we fed all of James Joyce into this system. And this is a very, very powerful thing. We thought, what would the Bible be like according to Joyce? So that was a failure. It was gibberish. It was just like, you know, because much of his genius in the like super compound words that are like 800 word syllables long are so brilliant. And speaking of resonance, they resonate with each other and make some other kind of meaning. So that was a failure. Then the next thing they did was they put all of my writing and lyrics and crossed it with the Bible.
Really?
And they just sent me a text 2 weeks ago that is 9,099 pages long. And it works a lot better because I write in very simple sentences, and it is me. I recognize my voice in this. It is me telling you the Bible, as if I know, as if I'm completely omniscient about, oh, here's how the beginning of the world was, and this is what this is how dominion over the animals happened. This is what happened, you know, and it's so creepy. Because when you hear writing, you picture the source. You know, it's like Doc Pomus, consider the source. That's something that, you know, Bob, you heard Lou say a million times, consider the source. Mm-hmm. Who is writing this stuff? Where is it coming from? So we're doing a bunch of other experiments now, and they're too wonky to go into, but it's teaching me a lot. Now, half of this text is just kind of nuts. It's like a little arbitrary. It's like it's word salad. It's like, yeah, you know, it's what you'd expect. The algorithms and the engines of how you say things and what conclusions you make are frightening. They're really like, so some of them are so beautiful.
Is this something you did with Tom Haidu? Is this,
yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yes, it's Tom is involved in it. So is Anton and Hoyola. So there, it's a whole group of people.
Mm. So I have to ask you. Are you going to set it to music?
Everything's set to music.
Ah.
Even something that doesn't have music.
Everything is
just
music.
Thinking. I'm just thinking, Bob, of the Christmas record. You know, there's a lot of Christmas themes in there. And stories that can, greatest story ever told, can be told so many times in so many ways, because there's so many of us, we can keep retelling it our own, you know, and there's something about that book that captures us. Yeah. We don't know where it comes from, this book, really, or what it's actually telling us. It tells us a million things. So it's not really about that. It's about who we are as people who are...
if it can parse it according to your language and your style, then who else should we invite to participate? People whose language and style we love, and you know what I mean? It would be amazing to tell the Christmas story 8 new ways.
Yes.
Or 10 new ways.
Yes, it would.
That could be our Christmas album.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good. The more we go into the impeachment, the more we realize the world is made of stories.
Yes.
You know, how many of the stories that Donald Trump told people captured their imaginations. And I believe that it's the job of artists to do a better job of making a better story that will be able to communicate. Now, how do you communicate with these 72 million American people who some of who believe that story, some of who are just, you know, just like, I'm a Republican, I'm fine with that, I just don't love the guy, but I'm more conservative. I'm from an era where we didn't fight with Republicans and Democrats didn't fight ever. We were just like, oh, I voted Republican, I vote. And now it's like battle to the death. So how did that happen? Stories. Mm-hmm. It happened through stories. Things that they now believe and they will fight to their own death. Now, this is like the power of the story.
Right.
And they're also, many of them are citing the Bible. This is what the Bible has told them is going to happen, should happen, and it is up to them to make it, to reify it. So they are, that is why they are there, and they are pounding crosses into the ground. And here we are in the Crusades. You know, you didn't think it was 1200? It's the year 1200. It's in some people's minds. They're going to save the world because they have this story. I don't know, maybe we have to create a lot of like crazy superheroes to do this. Or we have to make something that's so compelling that people will go, whoa, now that's a story.
Well, that's why what I like it, what I love about what you said is that through this project, that Tom told me a little bit about this stuff. And I think I spoke to you while you were there.
You did, yeah. Because we were also very nervous at that time. The pandemic was like happening.
Yeah, right.
I was like, I'll never get home from Australia.
Right. But, you know, telling that story that means so many different things to so many different people, filtering it through the language, the point of view, the voice of people, and that we should not only pick lefties, you know, that are, you know, like we should pick people from the whole spectrum. Maybe it's 12. I like the number 12. Or 13 is 13 is more
apostles.
Powerful. Well, yeah.
Gotta have a Judas in there.
Yeah. But, I mean, so, and if the story...
Gotta have Judas.
If the story is suddenly retold in so many different ways, and yet at the end of it, maybe there is that, you know, maybe there's that confluence of the essential message, and you end up with a center that everyone can agree on. That would be unbelievable.
I don't think anyone's ever going to agree on it, but I could imagine a big cacophonous party, you know, where people aren't accusing somebody of being wrong about it. We're all wrong. We're all wrong. We're all right. You know, like
exactly.
So let's party. You know, we're never going to agree. And truth isn't a concept that we need to go for. I mean, one of my cultural heroes is Timothy Morton, and he has a podcast now that's really quite amazing. He's of course an ecology philosopher, writes Hyperobjects and, you know, books on these events and of the mind. And he's like, okay, so he put something out about the last Wednesday, which was the attack on the Capitol. Mm. And he goes through the whole thing about the horror of it, and then he goes, so what do we do as artists? What should we be thinking? You know, how can you face that? What should we do? We can't just sit here going, oh, that's bad. You know, he said, okay, three things: beauty, ambiguity, and irony. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm not going to go for the truth thing, because we're just going to cudgel each other to death with my truth and your truth. You know, beauty, ambiguity, an irony.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. So I think those are good mottos for artists in the, at the moment, you know.
Yeah, I didn't want to break in because it sounded like the making of a potential, I don't know about bestseller, but something that actually is pretty important for the world to experience right now. But I did want to wrap, and maybe the best way to wrap, why don't we end actually with a couple of stories, a quick one from each of you, and I'm going to suggest a subject. Since we were talking a little bit about failed political leadership, you had a brief political career, Lori, when you ran for student council president, and you had a bit of an encounter with a political leader. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, you mean Jack. Okay. Jack. Yeah, Jack Kennedy was my hero because he broke his back, and I had broken my back. So I was like, he's president. I also have a broken back. So anyway, when I was 12, I wrote him a letter. And he was running in the primaries in Wisconsin, which was near me in Illinois. And so it seemed like, wow, he's in the area, so I can write him a letter. Wrote him a letter saying, "Dear Senator Kennedy, I really admire the way you're running your campaign. I'm running for president of my student council, and can you give me some advice?" No. Okay, so he wrote back to me. Kind of a long letter, you know. It was like many points on it. And one of them was, the one that I really remember the best, is find out what the students want and promise it. Mm. In other words, to be a rep, be a representative. Don't make up something that you want. Okay. Find out what they want and then get it for them.
Well, no. He didn't say get it. He said promise it.
Promise it. He did say promise it.
That was okay. Like, I'm
it's
like...
It's true. Oh, it's true. Okay. So then a couple of months go by. Wrote him a letter again saying, I'm really sorry, I haven't been in touch. I've been really busy. You know, 12-year-olds are just like, the world revolves around me. I won the election, and best wishes in your own campaign. Sincerely, Lori Anderson. Okay, so what happens next is, ding dong. We never got packages or like deliveries like this. There was a delivery guy and a truck came up to the house, and he had a telegram, and he had a long white box. And the telegram said, congratulations on your election. And in the box was 12 long-stemmed red roses to me, a 12-year-old girl. And
wow, that's
of course,
incredible.
the next day, the Glen Island News front pages, Jack Kennedy sends roses to local girl, you know, and every woman in town fell in love with Jack. You know, he was, what's he doing? Like, this is like helping this little kid. Yep. Anyway, I did not know at that time, actually, that the story of his dad, Joe, and the daughter who he had lobotomized. I did not know that story until I was back in Wisconsin about 50 years later. Seeing the Kennedy Art Center, I said, "What? That looks like a hospital." He said, "It is a hospital. It was a hospital, and it was the main hospital for the lobotomist who lobotomized an 18-year-old, lovely, smart girl who happened to be gay. Not a good thing if you're running for press or if your son is going to do anything, you know. So without asking his wife or anybody else, Joe sent her out. And she was lobotomized, and she became a 2-year-old.
Oh, my God.
Who wore diapers for the rest of her life and had no mind.
Oh, my God.
And died, I think, in 2005 or 6, with all the Kennedys at their side saying, we had this girl, sister, who was differently abled, blah, 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 differently abled because her father had a hole drilled into her head. Because of ambition. Mm-hmm. And so the ambition that was driving Jack to win that election was like the House of Atreus or something. It was like really, you know, raw. It was raw. And it would stop at nothing. So I still have the letter, but I have a different feeling about it.
Yeah, wow. Okay, there's nothing I can say after that. I mean, seriously, Brian.
Now, Bob, we'll take a rain check on your story.
Yes.
Let's do this again.
I'll mail it in. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well, yeah. You know, getting you guys together is a little bit of a scheduling challenge because you're always busy. But basically, you have an open invitation anytime.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I would love that. And any excuse to spend time together, yep. It's great.
Same.
You know, I was telling him that really the last time that we were out of the country, or the last time that I was in the United States, rather, was with you when we did that.
That's right.
That event at your place.
For your cool thing, yeah.
And then you know, from there we went back to Toronto and then to the islands for a minute.
Right.
Until we got the notice to say, go home now.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah. And here we still are.
Yeah. So my last trip into the States, and my next one's going to be Saturday, but my last trip into the States was to go to your house.
Yeah. That's so great. Okay. I'm going to see you both for real soon.
Yes. All right. That's great. So. And last point, you now have a project ahead of you, which is the Christmas album, but I'm going to suggest picking up on an earlier spot. We have a great composer. We have a great producer, and we have a yawning gap for the great anthem for positive social change of our time. So okay. get at it.
Get busy. You know,
write it. Write
okay.
it. The world needs it.
Yes, sir.
And you can and you can premiere it on our next podcast. How about that?
Well, thank you. We'll get busy right away.
We'll get on that.
All right.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
Bye, all right, thank everybody. You. Lots of love, Lori.
Lots of love to you.
Bye. Olivia, wow. Wasn't that an amazing conversation?
Oh, it was. I it feels like a real privilege to be able to listen in on this one.
Yeah, I felt like I had a ringside seat to two great minds in full flight. I thought there were some themes that really resonated pretty deeply with me. How about you?
Absolutely. Lori talking about the younger generation and the lack of the anthem we have, that definitely resonated with me because, you know, I think there's this, should I say how old I am, Brian?
Yeah, you can say how old you are. Absolutely. It's not a shameful admission.
So I just turned 23 years old, which puts me on this funny cusp of Gen Z to millennial and, you know, in that demographic, I absolutely feel that pressure on young people and feeling responsible for, you know, fixing climate change and calling out our racist relatives and, you know, using all of the tools at our disposal to do so. There's this kind of common saying on the internet among young people where sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, I shouldn't have been born in this generation. But I think that longing for another era and longing for simpler times is really just a longing for community and, you know, a real sense of passion. So the idea of an anthem is a really special thing when you think about it, because it's something that we lack, but something that I think we're really capable of at the same time.
Oh, for sure. And I have to say, on behalf of my generation, the ones that handed this great steaming mess to yours, you know, we all lived through the challenges of our times uniquely, because there's never been anything quite like it before. You know, we had a generation faced with nuclear extinction when I was growing up. Before that, a world war. Before that, a Great Depression. And it always feels like we've been handed a horrendous burden. We're all going to do the best we can, but I think that your generation has so much positive energy and so much of an impulse, you know, and it's, well, it's not fair to say, okay, we messed it up, you guys go save the world for us. You know, I think that you've got so many of the right elements. You've got the creativity, you've got positive values, and, you know, that anthem is going to emerge, I'm absolutely sure, spontaneously and organically, and it could be the rallying cry that really leads to some of the changes we all want to see happen in the world.
Well, you'll find me in the crowd when it happens, Brian.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you know, I'm, you know, those of us with our canes and walkers might just be trudging along behind you guys.
Anyway. Maybe I'll give you a push, Brian.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Just don't kick me to the curb. Anyway, moving on to some more of our more regular business. Do you have a few things to share with our audience?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm sure they know the drill by now, but for all things Glenn Gould, you can visit us at www.glenngould.ca. You'll find all of the latest stuff we're up to at the Glenn Gould Foundation. And of course, you will see that big red button on the top that says donate. We are a registered Canadian charity, and every little bit counts. Whatever you can give, we appreciate.
Absolutely. We are so grateful for your support, and we hope you'll keep joining us for every new episode of The Gould Standard. And now, just to sort of clear the air and take us back to a simpler and more naive time, perhaps we can let our dear friend, Mr. Edison, play us out. Mr. Edison, if you will.